Accession number 27775, Mr. Ted Hancock, Reel 2. Now, could you tell us a bit about how your role in the show developed? Because you're sort of going from 11, 12, getting older all the time. Did your role develop? Tell me some of the things you did.
I was just generally on stage, whatever the play or playlet was, I would be a supporting performer in odd little ways, you know, whether it was rather like the Crazy Gang, you know, that you had different, you had say two mainstays, and then we used to in the Crazy Gang, people used to run in and out, and so for instance, just a minute, there's a blind man outside. He said he wants to see you, you know, and there were silly little jokes like that running through all the time, of all types of things, and it might be my role to just run on and say one line or something like that, you know.
Now, when did you start doing your sort of yodeling and your bird impressions? When did that start?
All the way through, bit by bit.
Well, tell us about that. Tell us about which came first.
Well, my original bird impressions were when I was struck ill when I was a baby, and several times they gave me the last rites, and they said he will never, and I had throat operations when I was 6 years old. They said he'll never talk properly, he'll never walk properly, etc., etc. This was up in Leeds Infirmary, St James's Hospital as well, and then I was sent off to the, before I was 8 years old, about seven, I was sent off to the open air school, which is you know, for TB and chest problems, you see. And I couldn't breathe or anything, and I had rickets, many things wrong with me. But this is why I'm telling you this is eventually they used to put us out in the like they did wounded soldiers. They wrap you up in your blankets in your bed and push you out convalescing into the fresh air, and the birds used to come and jump up on my blanket. I couldn't move my fingers, or even one was that weak, couldn't move any hands or anything. And the birds used to jump on my camp bed, which was called a Hansfield camp bed, you know, an army camp bed. And the birds used to jump up on my chest, and they brought me back to life, gave me the will to live. And I used to whistle to them, etc., and vice versa. And the birds used to bring their families to me, and they all used to dance around me and buoy my spirits up, you see. And then, as I got stronger, I used to, there were 300 people in this particular canteen, all youngsters and everybody, and men and everything. I used to, they were very, very strict, because they used to beat you on your hands if you went and put your hand to get a biscuit or anything, or a piece of bread, before they, you know, like, rather like Dickens times, you know, with the lad that wanted more gruel, you know what I mean. And as I say, as it got better, then I used to grab a piece of bread and stick it in my pocket, and at night I used to go out, nobody knew, out into the woods and feed the birds, and they used to be waiting for me, you know, these birds that were wild birds, but they were all my friends.
Now, how many could you impersonate?
Very, very many, I don't know. But all the different...
I mean, was it actually an act? I mean, actually like it? Or
Yes. Oh, yeah, they're wonderful. A wonderful act, and people couldn't believe it. And I used to imitate the violin and the cello. I can't do it now somewhere because it's all gone, but let me think. And I used to make the you know, that type of thing. I can't do it now, but I used to do it perfectly. And
the bird impressions, what were they like? I know you can't do any of these because your teeth have changed, but I mean...
No, but I can't remember. I've got to go into the thinking mode, really.
I know what you mean. Yeah.
To remember it and bring it back. And also, you've got to make your mouth pliable. My mouth is no longer pliable, but you've got to make it like warming up a runner, you know.
Now, what about yodeling?
Can't hear. I just taught myself that. But through the bird impressions.
Was that because that was quite popular for a time? Was it popular then?
They taught me years later. This song was with Frank Highfield, who years later he appeared on the same stage in the Channel Isles as we did, just after the war. And Frank Highfield, he had a number one pop thing, and I thought I should have done something like that. And his song was, "They taught me to yodel, they taught me to yodel."
Now, hang on, that's after the war, though. I mean, what did you do? I mean, did you have any particular songs or?
No, just general. You had a little. I can't remember all of it, but I had a little routine of saying, going to Switzerland, and I met this chap coming down the mountain, and as I met him come down the mountain, he said, and so on, and it used to build it up from there. I can't remember exactly with it all.
What else were you doing? Anything else you did on stage?
Mainly only singing little songs, in groups and with one another, you know. Can't really remember there any more of that at the moment.
So, and what about the baggage role? You were going to talk about that. When the war started, you did quite a lot. What were you doing with the baggage?
Well, when we were forming the show, we had to have some skips and travel trunks, etc. These big, big ones like this type of thing, theatre baskets. And that, strangely enough, is the theatre baskets had little wheels on them, and they would move to left to right, but they wouldn't move around in a circle or across, they'd only move front and back, from side to side on these things. So little tiny wheels, and that's how we transported them. Along the pavements and the platforms.
So you put the stage baggage in these theatre baskets.
That's right. We had our private cases. Each individual person had a private suitcase, and then we had all the props and everything that went into the theatre baggage. And we went in Leeds to buy. I remember we went down to the theatrical or places where you could buy baskets and things. And we bought all these baskets, etc., to transport the stuff around, you see.
Now, was it difficult getting the sort of clothing for this? Because of a clothing ration. Tell us about that.
Clothing was rationed. You were only allowed a few points per person. But strange enough, our family business. My mother's family business was a supply company, warehouse, etc. And so we used to get a few things off the coupons, and then also we ordered our jackets and flannels, and trilbies, etc. And so on.
Hang on, you're on a microphone. Hang on, they can't see. There's no point showing pictures. Yeah.
Oh, no. 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 I was going to show you there, just to show you. Sorry. Yep. We ordered for all the troop Ferradors, cream Ferradors with a nigger brown hat band, which is you know, like a pop group of today, because all the people that were in Leeds had cloth caps and heavy, dark coloured clothing, but these were bright cream, beige, pink, you know, and the same with the check jacket.
So they were supplied by your family firm?
Yeah.
So had they made up with your mother by then, or was that just...
Well, they were always they were always talking to one another, but they didn't support her very well, you know.
So this was just the least they could do, sort
that's
of
right,
thing.
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
Anything else?
Actually, the my uncle, who wasn't really an uncle that was head of the firm, he was very disposed to my mother, but he wasn't allowed to be. You know what I mean? So. They were very cruel, really, the whole family to her, really, and me.
Now, what happened next, then? What do you remember of the shows you put on? There's so many places you went to. I know you've got... Do you remember anything in particular or that you want to comment on?
We went to hundreds and hundreds of shows and troop camps, naval dockyards, Air Force, the aerodromes, Blackpool... munitions factory, Vickers Armstrong's, right up to Edinburgh and right down to John O'Groats, Land's End, and Billy Butlin's. We were redcoats in Billy Butlin's for him. Our show went there, and every time we went there, we had to use his redcoats instead of our jackets, you know. So it was Skegness and Filey and Pontins down in the south, and all the civic halls and from Sheffield to Coventry to Birmingham to Hull. All those places were being blitzed at the time. Wherever there was a blitz, we were sent to keep the public happy.
Now, were you always just a show on your own? I mean,
yes.
Would you occupy... There wouldn't be another show on the theatre at the same time?
Strange enough, we used to entertain in the cinemas as well. There was the organ came up in the middle of the show. We would either go on before or after. Sometimes there would be another show... And while you were entertaining in the cinemas, people could order silver tea and service on a tray in the audience. It was a shilling a time or something. Very expensive thing to do in those days, but they were allowed to do that. And as I say, we used to entertain in the cinemas, even down in we've entertained in the major cinemas in Trafalgar Square, you know. And right up in the same up north.
And did you always go down well?
Yeah, 100%. And we've entertained in the open air theatre in Regent Street, in Regent's Park. And 20 years later, I'm photographing all the greats, who even Laurence Olivier. It was many, many years before he managed to. Appear at the Regent's Park Theatre. It's like winning the football cup, you know. If you've appeared at Regent's Park Open Theatre, you know, one of those.
Now tell me about the effects of the bombing and the Blitz and what it did. You know, you saw of it.
I was in amongst the major Blitzes many, many times, and born a charmed life all the way through. All our cast, we've never ever had a scratch. We were in Waterloo Theatre Station one day, and in those days everything went by train. All the postage, the post goes, huge mountains of mail, and we used to sometimes sit and lie and sleep, waiting for a train in the middle of the night, reconnection. And the Blitz would come, the aircraft would come over and bomb the station, and all the roof of glass a lot of it would come showering down in shards of glass, and it used to kill people all around us, and it never scratched us in any way, shape or form. Amazing that that happened a lot. And I sometimes used to have to get the a Waterloo or a station up and down the country, knock on the door of the station master and wake him up and make him hold a train for us, and because we had Winston Churchill's power behind us, and he used to hold a train that was being delayed by bombs or whatever, so that we got our connection to take us up to the next place, you know what I mean. And so I'd got at 11, 12 years, I've got a huge amount of power in a way, you know what I mean.
Did you see much of the damage done by the Blitz?
Oh yes, huge amount. It used to be in Coventry and Sheffield and everywhere, and we'd go down, even in London, we'd go down Westminster Tube, and we all used to sleep in the, for safety, you used to rush, when the air raid went off, anybody would rush to an air raid shelter or down into the tubes. Well, we used to rush down into the Westminster Tube, for instance, and I found that the coziest place for me was to, after we'd entertained the troops sometimes and the public in the tube to keep them happy, then they all used to go to sleep and find their own little knots, like chickens on a rack and a perch. And I used to perch myself, couldn't do that nowadays because I'm hugely, you know, big, but in those days I was thin, and I used to tuck myself behind the live rail and the concave of the wall and roll my overcoat up and put my head on the live rail and go to sleep. But the live rails were all turned off from, say, 12 o'clock till 5 o'clock in the morning, and then we were all told to get up and go, and when we'd gone they would turn the live on again, you know. And so that's that.
Did you remember any of the shows you did down in the tube? I mean, what would you do just on the platform?
Just anything, you know, just get people singing, and we might do a few little tap down steps, and everybody's eating their sandwiches and apples and having a thermos flask or whatever, you know. And everybody used to share their food between us all, one way or another, you know. However little you had, you shared it with the next person, because we all thought that the next day was our last, that day was going to be our last, you know. And sometimes you'd come out of a situation like that, and literally you'd been down the shelter and you came out and you found there were no houses on either side of you, and the house that you're living in was still standing. Or opposite, you come up and there was no house there. Or a street of houses has gone, you know. They used to have a special name. I can't remember the name of a special bomb that used to literally take most of the houses of the street one bomb away.
A landmine, parachute landmine.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
Now, what's the next thing you remember happening during your wartime years? You're doing this from 41. I'm not quite sure whether you can differentiate between the years, you know.
Not really. It just went on. You didn't do this all through the winter. Mostly it was in the summer, you see. And we also used to do radio shows from the munitions factory.
Well, tell us about that.
That was to entertain the munition workers. It was called, we used to do holidays at home as well in the parks for people, you know.
Well, tell us about the wireless show. What was that like? That was at a munitions factory.
Yeah, munitions. I'm trying to think of the name of it at the moment.
Was it just once, or did you do it more than once?
No, we did it quite a few times.
Workers' playtime.
That's what it was. That's right. The workers' playtime. And other types of shows.
And what was it like, a workers' playtime? Because
you went on all the canteen, all the people used to come in, like a huge canteen of a possibly 300 or 400 workers from a factory in this huge, huge assembly hall like an aircraft hangar. And it used to be steaming with stainless steel containers and so on. And the workers had to file in. You had sometimes, say, three or four sittings, half an hour sittings or a quarter of an hour sittings. And the workers would file in, and you'd hear this huge noise of stainless steel cutlery going bang, 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 bang. Tremendous noise, tremendous steam, and the smell of vegetables and things en masse, you know. And then the workers used to sit down quickly, eat their meal, and a tremendous noise, and we used to perform little shows for the various ones. One set of people would come in, and we'd do a half-hour show, a quarter-of-an-hour show. They would go, and then we'd repeat it, same sort of thing again.
But these were actually broadcast, some of them?
Some of them were, yes.
How did they tape microphone you?
They were big mics, very big ones. And there were different people.
Did you feel nervous going on the radio, the wireless?
No, not at that time, because I'd got used to the show. When I originally went on the stage, I was petrified.
Oh, you had stage nerves?
Petrified.
How bad was it?
Very, very bad. Tremendous. My stepfather gradually, it's like riding a bike, you gradually, stage by stage, you're introduced into other little things and it becomes normal.
And so that was the workers' playtime. Any other special shows you did?
Just general shows with all the troop camps, as I say, all the naval dockyards.
Now, the troops can be a difficult audience if they're not in the mood, especially. Yeah. Were they always all right with you, though?
1,000%. 1,000%, because we used to make jokes to the troops and tell them to get settled. So if you're not happy with the seat, sit on your helmet, and things like that. Silly little jokes that used to relax them all. And we used to sing songs that made them homesick.
But you didn't go blue. You didn't bring any more adult material, as they call it now.
No. My stepfather never ever. Actually, when you went from town to town, even with those shows, you had what they call watch committees in various towns. And if the watch committee didn't like the material that you were doing, they would stop the show. And it might be very innocuous and inoffensive thing. It might be in the script. It might be something that you would normally, everybody in the world would say virtually, and yet all of a sudden you get an official that would say, "Oh, that's a bit rude," you know. And it wasn't at all, but the official thought it was, you know. And can't have that in the act, you know. So he'd cut it out. So then you go to another town and the other town says, "Oh, nothing wrong with that." And so on and so on.
So you put it back.
So put it back, yeah.
Did the show develop at all, get bigger or smaller or what?
No, it was very big to begin with, and it got smaller as we travelled.
Now, why did it get smaller?
Well, we found that it was too hard to handle. I couldn't handle all the huge amount of stuff that had to go, and everything had to be transported by British Rail or by a lorry. And there were virtually no lorries available, and we used to travel British Rail used to supply us with stickers, and we used to travel even on the Queen's train or whatever. We would stick. I used to have a bundle of stickers, and it used to say, "This carriage is reserved for Victory Follies. No one is allowed to go in there in that carriage." You see. Now, the rest of the train was absolutely packed to the gunwales, but we had our carriages reserved. And I used to liaise with the various porters or station masters and make sure that we got our first-class carriages. See, we always travel first-class or, or 90% of the time, which was a very expensive thing to do if you were a private person.
Now, were there any other shows set up?
I often used to travel myself after putting all the luggage into the guards' vans. There are usually one, two or three guards' vans on each train. And we used to put all the luggage in there, and I was responsible for it. Some of the heavy one, the ordinary cases had to go in one guard's van, and the big skips had to go in another one, or wherever they could fit it in. And you had people in those days, that the odd person who was an invalid would travel in the guard's van, and you had the guardsman used to travel in the guard's van, and there was one little tiny little light that he used to sit over a desk and book in and out all this stuff that went in the van, you see. And I used to travel in there with cycles, pigs, the pigeons that used to be put in there for the air ministry and for the troops for sending messages by pigeons, and I'd be in there with pigeons, ducks, geese, pigs, anything, and have to travel the whole journey there, you know, for various reasons, you know. Very uncomfortable.
Were you the only sort of show set up by you know, Churchill's request at that time?
Yeah, but no, Huey Green's show was also there. But
what was that called?
I don't know, just Huey Green's show, I think. But he was very small, very minor. We appeared at Kingsway Theatre down in town.
Did you meet Huey Green much? Or
a couple of times, yeah. And then years later, I used to photograph him in Fleet Street.
Were you in competition with them, or were they just doing the same job as you?
No, weren't really in competition. We were the big ones, and he was just doing a few little shows.
Now, what did you do you did the shows in the winter, did you, or the summer?
No.
You did the shows in the summer.
Mainly in 6 months or 8 months of the shows.
In the summer.
And then a break in the winter. Yeah.
And what would you do during the break, the winter breaks?
Can't remember really. Just I was more or less like a street urchin doing odd little things, you know. Had no. I had no schooling at that time and everything. Just could do anything I wanted to, you know. Going to the pleasure beach and or whatever. But